Academy of Management's Organization and Management Theory Division for the best paper based on a dissertation. Jacob.
Okay, well, first of all, I wanted to thank Richard and Hoyt for the invitation to speak at this event. I have been looking forward to it, and thanks also to the Neubauer Collegium for supporting this wonderful opportunity for conversation between those of us who are speaking who have not met each other, and of course, with you all. So this paper, Finding Cultural Holes, I should say, first of all, is co-authored with, moving in a clockwise fashion, Gerald Vilhena, Martin Roswell, Jevin West, James Evans, and Carl Bergstrom, and is coming out at some point in the indeterminate future in Sociological Science, which, if you don't know about it, is a fantastic new open access journal. So first, as a little bit of prelude for my talk today, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about structure and culture, or for all intents and purposes for this talk, the relationship between networks and content. And in a way, I guess I'm sort of serving as a bridge between the discussion of networks that went before and the discussion of content, which will be the focus of this session. So for these purposes, I'm going to take the definition of structure, particularly social structure, from Pachucki and Breiger's Annual Review of Sociology piece on cultural holes, which provides the organizing metaphor for this paper. That is, structure is defined as the patterning of social connections among individuals, among groups, and other aggregates. And cultural, for these purposes, will mean meanings, local practices, discourse, repertoires, and norms. Now, sociologists of culture study many, many diverse objects. The organizing principle among those objects, for our purposes, the thing that underlies that apparent diversity is the capacity to circulate. And for us, this provides an analytical focus on human communication, which we construe as the process by which values, tastes, styles, logics, other such things are transmitted among people. So cultural circulation will be kind of the core concept here. I guess it goes without saying that network analysis, particularly social network analysis, privileges structure. Indeed, it is the method par excellence of structural analysis in contemporary sociology. And what Pachucki and Breiger very usefully do in this review piece is talk about the increased dialogue that has occurred between analysts of social structure, and particularly analysts of social networks, and the sociology of culture. And as their kind of point of analogy, they build on a very influential concept in network analysis called structural holes, introduced by the colleague of many of you at Chicago, Ron Burt, which refers to sort of gaps in social structure. And the bridging of those gaps can often be a strategically useful and interesting thing to do. So Pachucki and Breiger, in a way, riffing on what they themselves are doing in bridging these conversations about networks and culture, introduce this idea of cultural holes, gaps in this case, the cultural fabric, which in some cases may be aligned with, in other cases may be disjoint with, gaps in social structure. Culture may help create or facilitate bridging across those structural gaps. So we want to interrogate this conversation about structure and culture, networks and content, in the context of scientific communication. And so for us, insofar as we want to characterize culture by its shared and communicated quality, and point out that differences in communicated content often reflect underlying cultural differences in tastes or in interests, we want to define cultural holes for us in terms of the communicative burden that's placed on parties to some kind of interaction. One way to put a kind of ethno-methodological gloss on what we're doing is to say that more work is required to sustain an interaction when there are underlying cultural differences that lead one or the other parties to transmit streams of unfamiliar or unexpected symbols and behaviors. So that's the kind of picture that we have in mind of cultural holes, and we're going to look at this now in the context of scientific communication. Scientific communication is typically studied using the machinery of citation analysis. And citation analysis, this is a community-level map of a number of scientific journals organized by the citation relationships between them. So what citations are good at are revealing some of this social organization of scientific work, the relationships between these fields. They're actually quite good at picking up patterns of interdisciplinary formation or disciplinary dissolution. So in other words, what they're good at pointing out are patterns of social connections, and remember that the act of citation is often less a gesture of genealogical relationship to the content of the article and more of a gesture of sort of social structural belonging. So they're good at pointing out patternings of social connection among individuals, among groups, and among other aggregates, but what they conceal, because you don't have it there, right? The content isn't in the citations. They're hiding the meanings, the practices, the discourse, the repertoire, in some cases, depending on what you're talking about, the norms. In other words, they're hiding from our analysis of scholarly communication the culture part. The kind of point of departure for us starts with this French philosopher Étienne Bonnot de Condillac. So he has this very pithy saying, every science requires a special language because every science has its own ideas, right? So scientific communities are often organized around special languages that are used to express the concepts that are of intense interest to those fields. So here, Sewell Wright of the University of Chicago, right, might say fitness landscape, and that sort of refers very clearly to a whole complex of concepts. There's some very funny stories I can tell you about him using guinea pigs as erasers on the chalkboard. But in any case, so when someone like Sewell Wright says fitness landscape to people in his community of evolutionary biology, that says a lot, and very little interpretive work is required to figure out what fitness landscape means. When someone outside of that community, say Lee Fleming, uses fitness landscape as a construct in a paper analyzing inventive behavior, he has to explain what it means. And for his readers, much interpretive effort is required to figure out what on earth this fitness landscape concept is doing. So this kind of scholarly jargon can facilitate communication. So this is an abstract from the archive in my original field of high energy theory. And two people in this area, this is extremely meaningful. It is no longer meaningful to me. But to most of us in the audience, it's just a bunch of words that it would take, you know, probably a year of effort to truly understand what's being said in that abstract. For people within the community, it's very clear what they're talking about and why this paper might be worth reading. So it facilitates communication, but it impedes it. And jargon is advised to be avoided when communicating medical information to patients, when publishing material intended for public outreach, or, as we're doing here today, presenting technical information to a multidisciplinary audience. So one of the key steps that we wanted to do in this paper is think about modeling culture through thinking about and modeling communication. So what I'm going to do today is first present to you a very simple, actually information theoretic model of communication, and it works like this. So you can imagine here we have a writer and a reader who are positioned in the same kind of scholarly community. And to make things a little more concrete, I'll just put pictures so you can see who they are. Norbert Wiener and Claude Shannon. So, okay, the writer and the reader are going to engage in some communicative interaction. And the writer does this by basically drawing phrases from a pool of possible phrases that he might use to communicate according to some probability distribution. So, some things are maybe of intense interest. They will be very likely to be selected and transmitted. Some things, much less so. And we want to think about, okay, well, remembering this idea of interpretive effort that I've been kind of glossing here, how do we actually relate this probability distribution to the interpretive effort that's required of the reader? So you might make the guess that essentially the more rare something is, the more interpretive effort is required. So here as we move towards zero, we see things that are encountered very, very infrequently, and like the example from you know, N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, something that I imagine most of us encounter very infrequently, the interpretive effort required is very high. And it turns out that there, in the language of information theory, this relationship is expressed by the optimal encoding of symbols that are transmitted according to some probability distribution, just as the negative log of that probability. So things that are extremely infrequent have very long words, in other words, require a lot of interpretive effort, long code words, I should say, and things that are transmitted very frequently require very little interpretive effort. So from this, we can actually calculate something. It's formally an entropy, but what we can think of it as is the expected message length, or even better, the expected interpretive effort required when someone from this community is talking to someone else in the same community. So one way to kind of make this a little bit more meaningful is to say, okay, well, if my probability distribution over phrases is relatively flat, in other words, if there's a huge body of stuff that we all like to talk about many, many different things, right, then the entropy will be very high. In other words, there will be lots of symbols, all of them will be encountered relatively infrequently, so each individual thing will require some online work to decipher. When on the other hand, and this is of course what characterizes disciplinary communities, there is tight concentration on some things as being of intense interest, and most things are relatively infrequently encountered, that's when we see a situation of low entropy, right? So the expected interpretive effort is much lower. That's part of what we mean by saying that we have a common language within some discipline, as well as a common set of interests. Now, let's change it up a little bit and look at interdisciplinary communication. So in this case, the phrases will be generated according to the same probability distribution, but the reader now has a different probability distribution of encountering new phrases. So say for someone from the mathematics community, phrases about stochastic processes or whatnot might be discussed very frequently. For people in the anthropological community, that's Gregory Bateson, those things might typically be encountered less frequently, and that's represented by a different interpretive effort for that given phrase. The mathematical object that we can use to measure that is something called the cross entropy, which you can think of as the expected interpretive effort now when people from two different communities are talking to one another. And the ratio of the interpretive effort within a community and between communities, that's what we can think of as the interpretive, or the efficiency of their communication. So now we can make some sort of ideal typical situations. Let's say that we have two individuals who come from communities that share many matters of concern, right? So in that scenario, the cross entropy will actually be relatively small. It will be quite comparable to the entropy within one of the given communities. Then the communication will be efficient, and we can think of that as saying that there's a small cultural hole between those communities. Little additional interpretive effort is required. In the situation where they have completely distinct probability distributions, in other words, I have the things that I'm very passionate about discussing, and you have things that you're very passionate about discussing, and those things are essentially complete non-overlapping, there will be a huge amount of interpretive effort required for us to communicate with one another. The string of symbols that I'm generating will require a lot of work to decipher. The string of symbols that you're generating will require a lot of effort for me to decipher. So the communication is inefficient, and we think of this as being a situation with a large cultural hole. Okay, so I can now sort of make a little dictionary of how we're measuring relative efficiency, the ratio of within field to between field expected interpretive effort, cultural holes as just the one minus that, and then for each field we can compute the average cultural hole. I should point out at this point that this method is actually quite practical. Something relatively similar to it is used by the preprint server archive to screen submissions for things that are, so they don't like to say this, but heterodox, let's say. So this is actually a joke submission. It's called Possible Bubbles of Space-Time Curvature in the South Pacific. I think this is too far away for most of you to read it, but anyone who is you know, participating in this new trend of intense critical interest in H.P. Lovecraft would rapidly recognize that this is basically a sort of parodic scientific account of the Call of Cthulhu. And so, obviously, typically they don't talk about cyclopean structures and gibbering madness in physics articles, so this would be screened in that way if it were not self-identified as a parody. Okay, so to sum up where we've gotten at this point, structure is going to be measured using citations. Culture is going to be measured using text. So I need to tell you a little bit about the data. We're looking at 1.5 million interconnected papers from JSTOR. The period studied is 20 years from 1990 to 2010. We're going to examine the 60 largest fields, which have more than 1,000 papers each. And what we do is within each field, we sample 500 of the papers and look at their trigram distribution, so three word phrases. Now, I have completely skated over the question of how fields are identified. This is something that James Evans raised in his conversation with the previous panelists about finding kind of mesoscopic structure in large networks. The tool that we use to do this is something called the map equation. Effectively, you can think of this as a way of providing a two-level description of a network, one that very efficiently describes, for those of you who are referring to random walk ideas, it effectively provides a very efficient compression of telling the story of the random walk on that network. So that's the machinery that we use to derive these scholarly fields. So we have a set of papers connected by citations. We construct the mesoscopic, the sort of structural field level entities using the map equation. I've told you now our model of communication and how we use that to think about this idea of cultural holes. So okay, now after all of this throat clearing and ramp up, what do we actually find? What is the turn in our little story of detection? So the first thing that is incredibly striking, so the orange are social science fields, and the blue are natural science fields, specifically biological sciences and statistics. And what you can see is that they are very clearly separated on the average amount of jargon. Okay, so natural sciences moving up to extracellular matrix have a huge amount of jargon. In other words, the cultural holes to all the other fields in our sample are very high. Others, like strategic management, have relatively little cultural hole. Now, what is quite striking is that this phenomenon of, if you pick, even with at the within field level, the barrier going one way or another, this is not something that has to do with the number of distinct terms, okay? So if you look at the number of different phrases that are used, they're actually all mixed up. With the light, it's a little bit hard to distinguish between them. But you can see that the biological sciences and social sciences are actually relatively interleaved. So it is not as if there are a huge number of distinct terms in extracellular matrix studies and not in work on U.S. constitutional law. Actually, there are a huge number of distinct terms in U.S. constitutional law. But if we look at the number of distinct phrases that appear per word that is used in the field in question, then things organize themselves very nicely. And in fact, we see that the biological sciences have very few distinct terms per word. Now, what this suggests is that there's actually a quite constrained syntax for combining terminology in the biological sciences as opposed to at least some of the social sciences. When we look at these fields organized on the one hand through distance via citation, and on the other hand, distance via cultural holes or jargon, in other words, when we look at the way that the space is structured socially or culturally, we see that there's actually some very interesting differences that show up. So here these blue fields, and the red is just not showing up with this projector at all. But effectively what we see is that things that are grouped together, so just focus on the blue field here, these are a few subfields in economics, they are grouped quite close together by citation, but now move apart when viewed in the context of culture. Now, how can we actually layer these two analyses on top of each other? How can we combine social structural or network analysis with this kind of cultural analysis? So we measure the structural distance between fields using the average citation path distance, and we project basically this distance matrix down into two dimensions using something called principal coordinate analysis. And this is the picture that we get. So fields' positions are determined by their citation distance, and the topography of the landscape, effectively, is determined by the cultural holes. So things that have big cultural holes between them will show up as well. I'll just show you kind of oceanic spaces. So we have this picture of kind of islands that are more and less rugged, that are in some cases separated by deep chasms. Here is the behavioral sciences, moving from kind of education through psychology, through sociology, down to economics and management. The ecological sciences, which are actually interestingly quite balkanized. And then over there, up in the corner, alone, is molecular biology, with systematic sort of sitting there in the middle. Now, concern, actually something raised by the one of the speakers in the previous panel, is all of this just artifactual? Is this something that is produced by the act of taking a high-dimensional object, so this is from Flatland, right, and embedding it in an inappropriately low dimension? So to check this, what we did was actually look at how cultural holes scale with citation distance in the full network. So in other words, we wanted to see whether this intuition that there was this rugged distribution of landscapes in some cases and not in others could be borne out directly from the data. So what I show here on your left are two plots of the characteristic decay of cultural distance or cultural holes with social distance. And some fields have very fast decay, some fields have very slow decay, which means that some fields are much more culturally isolated given their social position than others. So looking first at molecular biology, which typically has very high jargon and is very isolated in this way, it was quite surprising to us, in fact, that they tended to have quite slow scaling. So their neighboring landscape was actually relatively bereft of substantial cultural holes. Now we think of this in the following way. So if you imagine two molecular biologists talking to one another, one might want to talk about, say, the biology of the cell membrane, the other might be interested in the extracellular matrix, but they share a common kind of reductive substrate. They're interested in the same sets of proteins and molecules and so forth, so that allows them with their neighbors to actually communicate quite efficiently with few cultural barriers. If we consider the ecological sciences, by contrast, which when we zoom in are actually quite balkanized, what we find is that they have very quick fall-off in communicative efficiency. In other words, despite the kind of folk picture of ecology as being this holistic, kind of everyone happy together field, in fact, they're very balkanized and cut off one from another. This is the decay for the field devoted to the study of bears. And if you do not believe that that is really what this field is about, look at the most distinguishing phrases. I guarantee you that field is about bears. And why is that the case? If you imagine these two scientists talking to one another, well, one of them is like, hey, let me tell you the cool stuff that I found out about bear mating, right? And their colleague is like, no, I'm into voles. And they are kind of absorbed with these extreme particularities which lack this commensurable reductive substrate. The social sciences are a pleasant intermediate case where they actually have very moderate scaling, and you can actually move quite smoothly with a few bumps from one part to the next. So, given this overall picture, what does the analysis of cultural holes tell us? Well, first, we have four domains, three that are tied together by the scale of the things that they study: social sciences, ecological sciences, molecular biology, and statistics. The social sciences have, on average, lower jargon barriers to the whole field and relatively smooth interdomain communication. They're actually relatively integrated at the level of cultural wholes. The ecological sciences have higher jargon barriers one from another and inefficient communication with neighbors. We think of them as being balkanized by their particularities. And the molecular sciences have high average jargon barriers, high average cultural wholes, but they communicate efficiently with their immediate neighbors because they're all into this sort of world of molecular reduction. So these are kind of three ideal typical scaling pictures. Now I just want to take 2 minutes to talk a little bit about ways forward and then step back and talk about the role of interpretation in all of this. So ways forward, I mean, first of all, our model of scientific language is relatively crude. But because we focus here on modeling communication in a slightly more sophisticated way, it would be quite easy to plug in more sophisticated models of the generation of scientific language. You could use something like topic models, anything that gives you a sort of culturally specific way of generating streams of scientific language. It would also be interesting to expand the symbol set to include things like white space and the actual arrangement of white space to allow you to study things like poetry, where the actual mise en page, I think if I'm remembering the term correctly, is important, equations, that sort of thing. And we're very, very interested in studying temporality and the temporal dynamics of cultural wholes in jargon. So you might ask, you know, is my field from 20 years ago farther away from me than a neighboring field today? An interesting question. Our discussion here, we think, suggests that structure and culture are not alternatives, but truly complementary and cross-cutting, and we hope analysis will reveal co-constituting ways of looking at, in this case, scholarly communication, but I think many other forms of communication. One interesting hypothesis that might be worth following up is the way that the depth of cultural wholes relates to the advantage to individuals who try to reach across those cultural wholes. You might think that this is something where there's a sort of unimodal relationship, where if you're talking to people close by culturally, reaching across that gap isn't that valuable. If, on the other hand, there's a huge gap between you culturally, reaching across is similarly not valuable because no one really knows what to make of what you're doing. It's in that intermediate space that there might be most advantage to individuals who engage in that synthesis. As far as future possibilities go, one of the reasons that I really wanted to talk about this at this workshop was through listening to Richard and Hoyt describe the kinds of things that they were interested in doing. You could imagine having, say, poets that are connected by letter writing relationships or co-publication relationships or critical commentary relationships, and actually using the huge amounts of text that they generate to leverage this connection between, on the one hand, their social structural relationships, on the other hand, their jargon relationships. And I wanted to close by talking a little bit about what I think of all of this as really doing. Something that really struck me in everything that was said in the first panel was the huge amount of interpretive layering that's required to take these quantitative objects, these metrics, and bring them into something that we care about. So closeness vitality, or Shannon entropy, cross entropy, polynomial decays of things, right? These are not intrinsically meaningful things. They have to be translated to become relevant to our particular scholarly cultures. There is, in a way, a hole between the mathematical and computational objects as such and what we care about as scholars, and interpretive work is needed to get meaning out of the metrics. Now, this is, of course, true of natural scientists, it's true of social scientists, it's true of humanists. The difference is perhaps how far that chain has to go and how stable and standardized is the chain of translation, to put kind of a Latourian gloss on it. From my perspective, the amount of active labor that's required to engage in that act of interpretation, the alienness of the objects in question, gives us the capacity as analysts or interpreters, even more so the opportunity to be truly surprised. The new objects and representations confront interpreters with objects that resist typical procedures or categories of interpretation, our scholarly or hermeneutic habitus. Things can just go off the rails, as it were, when we're trying to figure out what to do with these weird objects. At the same time, the confrontation of the hermeneutic habitus and these alien objects, which Bourdieu would call a kind of hysteresis, can be generative of novel interpretations or even modes of interpretation. It's, in a way, an example of what Bilsua would call a conjuncture of different structures. To me, this is the vitality of mathematical